Welcome to the Isaka Podcast. On today's offstage and off-script edition of the podcast, we're speaking with John Dushinsky, a purpose-driven entrepreneur, consultant, and author who will be the closing keynote speaker at Isaka's 2019 EuroCAX CSX conference, which will take place October 16th through 18th in Geneva, Switzerland. Thank you for being with us today, John.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for the opportunity.
So why is being purpose-driven so important for professionals?
Let's define what we mean by purpose-driven before we talk about why it's so important, perhaps. Purpose-driven means that you're clear on what you do, you're clear on how you do it, and most companies and professionals are pretty clear on those two today. You know what you do when you go to work. You know what the company does. It makes widgets. It creates technology. It produces X, Y, Z. You know what it does. And you're pretty sure on most companies, at least you'd hope, how it's done. What are the SOPs? What are the standard processes? How does whatever the company delivers, whether it's a product or a service, how does it get created? The bit that tends to get lost in all this is why. Why has this group of human beings come together in this corporate structure to do the thing they do? And if the answer to that is to make profit, then that is not the why. That is a result of the why. And so purpose-driven companies are companies who have understood what that why is, who've got really clear what their purpose is, why they get up in the morning, why they work, why they innovate, why they create, why they make their product, why they serve their customers. Now, companies are going to be different. Every company will have a different purpose. But if you ask me why is it so important for professionals, it's because purpose-driven companies get and keep the best employees. So if you're a purpose-driven professional, then you're going to have more success in attracting and keeping employees. We know how much it costs companies with turnover of staff. We know how difficult it is to find and keep the best people. Purpose-driven companies typically find that their best employees are three times more likely to stay with them than companies who are not clear on why, who are clear on the what and how, but are not clear on the why. That's the first thing. The second thing is that you're likely to get more customers. So if you're a professional and you're a company, you're going to get customers who are more loyal. Approximately 70% of customers now are very comfortable recommending companies with purpose, and that's a 40% increase on a decade ago. Now, the third thing, and this is perhaps for the shareholders and the investors in the audience, this is perhaps the one that will perk up ears, but being purpose-driven makes more money. It delivers more value to shareholders. Purpose-led companies outperformed the S&P 500 by 10x between 1996 and 2011. I'll say that again. Purpose-driven companies outperformed the S&P 500 by 10x between 1996 and 2011. So these are data points that show that being purpose-driven is important because what it does is it helps you make more money. And the truth today is you make more money by making a difference. And what I stand for and what I'll be talking about at the event in Geneva in October is how you make more money and make a difference.
You've been described as a serial entrepreneur. What do you find so intriguing about entrepreneurship?
I'm not entirely sure what that means. I kind of go through life encountering with curiosity, seeing things, seeing concepts, seeing ideas, drawing connections between them. Perhaps connections that others haven't seen before, or connections in new ways. And then from that, being able to sort of articulate a vision, turn that connection into something that can be communicated and articulated, a kind of a what if we did this. And then it's really about enrolling and inspiring others to say, oh, that would be cool. Why don't we all try and do it together? The first thing about entrepreneurship is you can't be an entrepreneur on your own. You cannot change anything on your own. You might get a vision. You might see a connection between things. You might be able to articulate that. But in order to make any change, you need to enroll others. you need to use your words, you need to use your talents to be able to enroll and inspire others. That's what I think I see as the skill of an entrepreneur, is really putting the kernel of an idea on the table and ensuring that you've got great people around you. I was told very, very early in my career that I should always find and hire people that I consider to be smarter than myself, not just the goal of being the dumbest person in the room, but being the person in the room who speaks the least. So my goal is to put a kernel of an idea on the table, bring together and enroll people who I consider to be smarter than myself, to look at that and then shut up and get the hell out of the way while they go forward and make something magical out of it.
I saw in one of your past presentations, you cited that nearly half of jobs will be replaced by technology in the next 10 years, at least in some regions. What comes to mind when you think about that type of jarring possibility?
I get really excited by it. If you think about how the Industrial Revolution played out, and let's go all the way back to the cotton mills and the textile mills of Manchester and Liverpool and the very, very origins of the Industrial Revolution. It was based on the principle that we would need human beings to work the machines. There were capital owners, and these capital owners, who were the owners of the factories, they put into place these machines. And you needed human beings to work the machines. That's how the Industrial Revolution started. You got more productivity when the humans worked the machines, because the machines, by being worked by humans, the machines didn't do anything if the humans weren't there to work them. But you got more productivity, more growth, etc., more output from these machines if you had the human beings to work the machines. Now, that is the basis upon which we have built 150 years of industrialized growth. It's the basis of, we have needed human beings to work the machines. And in fact, we've built our education systems this way too. We've built our education systems so that we deliver a workforce with a good grounding in a variety of different subjects, but not particularly deep in any of them. And we're not training people to be creative or innovative, because what we want people to do is to be able to then go out and operate the machines in any one of a number of domains. That's how we've built our education system, and it's how we've built our industrial system. And it's served us very well up till now. But what's happening is that today, we don't need people to work the machines anymore. And that's the seismic shift. Because when we don't need people to work the machines, and you're right, within 10 years, it's estimated that about 50% of jobs in the U.S. are going to be done by machines or algorithms. And shifts at that scale, no ripple effects, are going to be felt in every family, every community, every company. There's a lot of talk about how all the U.S. and developed countries are heading towards massive levels of structural unemployment. That is false. I do not believe we're going there. Now, what's interesting about this, too, is it's not just the jobs that you think of as being sort of menial factory jobs, or even the sort of the highly mechanized factory jobs that are turning into jobs being done by machines and algorithms. There's a study by Oxford University that ranks jobs with probability of being replaced by technology within 10 to 15 years. And if you look at some of the jobs that have more than 90% chance of being replaced, you find some very surprising ones. You find things like butchers, accountants, real estate agents, budget analysts, groundskeeping workers. These are not jobs that you would expect to be replaced by technology, but they will be. So what we need to get, as the humans are no longer needed to work the machines, that then we are able to tap into something that is fundamentally human, which is that when we are given a little bit of freedom from needing to work the machines, when we're given the breathing room from ensuring our basic survival, then humans are free to seek more meaning. Because there's a couple of universal truths around this. One of the first universal truths around this is that every single human will want to leave a better world for their children and their grandchildren. We're just hardwired to do it. And it's built into our DNA. Just like, what am I going to eat today is built into our DNA. If we didn't ask that question, we wouldn't live very long. And by the same context, if we didn't ask the question of how are we going to improve the world that we live in, and how are we going to leave a better world for our kids and our grandkids, we wouldn't live very long either. It's a basic tenet of survival. Now, the way that we've built our system and our industrial system over the last 150 years has been about humans working the machines to create the output so that we can continue to grow the economy. Now we don't need the humans to work the machines anymore. The humans are free to ask themselves, well, what would I do if I didn't have to work the machines? And we're finding that people are tending towards things that have meaning for themselves, but more often than not, have meaning for the greater community. That's linking back to this purpose piece. Why do people look for meaning today? Well, we look for meaning because we have the opportunity to do it. We're kind of moving up Maslow's pyramid towards self-actualization, and we actually have the opportunity to say, well, I choose to do something that makes a difference for me and my community, because I don't have to go down the coal mine every day, because that is really the only way that I can provide for my family. I have choice. And as we move that further and further up there, we've got this space where we're searching for meaning. And if we're searching for meaning, we want to make a contribution. So why this notion of doing good and making money, making a difference and making money, is two separate notions. They have to be separate in a sort of industrial world, but in a post-industrial world, in a digital disruptive world, in what, fourth industrial revolution or whatever they're calling it these days, the two merge together. We look at the world by saying, actually, why can't I make money and make a difference? Why do I have to sacrifice the quality of life with my family and my ability to help and support my community in order to send my kids to college? Why do I have to make that sacrifice? And more millennials and digital, sort of first digital natives coming in to the workforce and to leadership positions are coming in with a value set that is very much around, I want to make a difference and I want to make money, and the two sit side by side. So back to your question around the importance of the disruption in the job market, we are seeing this new sense of possibility that is being enabled by technology. This new world, it's not a brave new world, at least that's not how I see it. It is a new world of opportunity where human beings are actually given the time and the space to be able to pursue the things that matter most to them. And because we are hardwired to create a better world for those that follow us, we are also now starting to ask questions around, how do I use my time for the betterment of others? How do we create a general purpose? How do we live with purpose? How do I buy from companies with purpose? And how do we bring purpose into every single part of our lives today?
Switching gears a bit, what are the biggest keys to successful communication when it comes to social innovation in the enterprise setting?
The keys to communication come back to this idea of clarity on the why. You know, it's very easy to talk about what you do and how you do it. But actually, the communication at that level is fairly transactional. And it's about the process, and it's about what we're doing. It's a set of tasks. We're communicating at a tactical level. When you get real communication, when you get real connection, what you get is something called enrollment. It's buy-in. When you really communicate effectively with people, you get not just their understanding, they're sitting there nodding and they know how to execute the tactics or the process, but you get their buy-in almost at an emotional level with the thing that you're sharing. They really get it. And to get it, you've got to understand not just what it is and how it works. You've got to understand and be aligned on why it's important. That's the really critical piece. And it's what differentiates so many companies that do this. The old example, but it's still so great, so I don't mind citing it. I mean, it's used again and again and again. But it is the example of Apple, who, if you look at them from the perspective of what, they're a technology company. They make computers and tablets, just like other companies do. On the how level, they have processes and they have SOPs and they have all sorts of things that are in place, just like any other company. But why do they do it? Well, they do it because they believe in disrupting the status quo, and they believe that technology can not just disrupt the status quo, but the technology can and should be made available for all to be able to do that. That's what makes a conversation about Apple different from a conversation about any other company that makes pieces of technology that are similar to the pieces of technology that Apple makes? It is that fundamental why. And when you speak to people who work there, they're all very clear that the reason they get up in the morning is to serve that why. It's to serve that purpose. That's the difference. So what makes successful communication? It's people need to be bought into the purpose. One of the other entrepreneurship opportunities that I've started in the last few years is an insect farm. And I do that because it's a powerfully purpose-driven business. We farm insects that eat food waste, and they become food that goes into the food chain and helps improve the health and sustainability of animal feed. So it's a very purpose-driven business. But it's not very sexy to try and recruit people to come and farm bugs for a living. In fact, it's fundamentally quite a challenge. So when we recruit people to come and work here, and we have mostly a young team, a millennial team, actually, when we recruit people, we're recruiting people on the purpose of taking something that's been thrown away and using it to make agriculture more efficient. We are recruiting on the purpose of sustainability and making sustainability reality. That's why people come to work for us. And that is what they're bought into. That is the communication that matters. Once they're bought into that, then you can work through all sorts of tactics and processes. You can deal with the fact that farming maggots and farming flies and farming insects is fundamentally not a particularly sexy and attractive thing to do, and you go home pretty smelly at the end of the day. And you can overcome all of those challenges, because what you're doing is inspiring people and communicating to them about the thing that really matters to them and something they care about, and they buy into it. And when they buy into it, then you open up all sorts of possibilities. So that is the key, the biggest key for me to successful communication, is communicating your purpose and then creating the space for people to buy into the what and the how through their actions.
How will the educational system need to adapt to keep pace with the evolving technology landscape?
So when I spend time with CEOs and business leaders, they're fairly unanimous in the fact that the education system at all levels now is not fit for purpose. I have a 14-year-old and an 8-year-old, and they have been educated in the Waldorf system, which is a Steiner system, which is designed to educate and promote creativity. I love how Ken Robinson puts this in one of his TED Talks. He says that education systems educate creativity out of kids. We need to have education systems that educate the creativity and nurture it within the kids. I've been very lucky that that's something that's been available for my kids, given where we live here in Canada. But education systems, education styles that enable the kids, enable young people, and this starts very young, to grow into their creativity rather than having it tested and normalized out of them. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that we need to have a realignment between the worlds of, once you get to sort of 16, 17, 18, and you go into what is currently called higher education, we need a realignment between that higher education and the needs of the workforce, which means that the two have to be much more closely aligned. You start to see it today in some of the vocational colleges, but it's still, in terms of the main universities, it's still a long way. Working with universities today and getting universities to move quickly is a challenge. And I'm also going to approach this from a perspective as a business owner who works with a number of universities. It is very challenging to get the universities to move at the pace of the world around us. And there's all sorts of reasons for that. It's down to how universities manage IP with their faculty. There's a vast sort of array of things that can be deployed in this space. The reality, though, is we've got to start very young. We've got to stop educating creativity out of kids. We have to start nurturing that creativity. The other thing we need to do is we need to get kids out of the classroom and into nature. Nature and exposure to nature and the ability to be in nature and feel some kind of ease in that environment builds capacities, and it's those capacities that are so fundamental when you get into the workforce. So creativity, and the capacity, the self-resilience that you get from being in nature through education systems, I would also put a very strong push as part of that creativity. All of the things that we've cut out of our education systems in most of the developed world, the music, the arts, those are the things that actually really build the character and the resilience. Struggling with a piece of music and practicing it over and over again teaches you a lot more than an SAT test will ever teach you. And then we need a higher education system that is much more closely aligned to the needs of business and is not so stodgy. So those are some of the things that we need to be doing in order to be able to realign this. And I think it's also interesting to note that if you look at the founders or CEOs of Microsoft, Apple, SAP, Oracle, Google, Facebook, they are all college dropouts. Because at one point they had ideas, they wanted to go quickly, and they found that the universities were not a strong enough container to do that. That is indicative of some of the challenges that I think we're facing in that space.
John, thank you so much for sharing your insights with the ISACA podcast audience today. And we're looking forward to hearing more in October at EuroCAC CSX in Geneva.
Thank you very much. I'm very much looking forward to seeing you all there as well. And thank you for the chance to share some thoughts today.
That's our program for today. For more on the 2019 EuroCAC CSX conference, visit isaca.org/conferences.